Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
It has been just over a century since the last living passenger pigeon died. As recently as the 1850s, there were literally billions of them in North America, but they were quickly done in by food and leisure hunters and habitat depletion. Modern environmentalism came too late to save the passenger pigeon from extinction, but what if modern science could bring it back to life? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The passenger pigeon is among a number of species missing from the landscape as a direct result of human activity. The list includes some species of toads, whales, crows, even perhaps our lost human cousins, the Neanderthals. Some experts believe it is now possible to use bioengineering to bring some of these creatures back and reintroduce them into the wild. The science is challenging, but it's coming along. The question is, would this be the right thing to do? Journalist M.R. O'Connor explores this tantalizing question in her new book, Resurrection Science: Conservation, De-Extinction, and the Precarious Future of Wild Things. Maura, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
It has been widely reported that we are living in what could be considered the sixth great period of extinction of species in the history of the Earth. It's hard to hear that and not feel really alarmed.
It is. I grew up with the idea of a sixth extinction, probably from middle school. This was something that I was taught, that there are tens of thousands of species going extinct. And that's kind of hard to relate to. It's a truly overwhelming thing to consider.
It's a relatively recent development in human history that we even care about our role in wiping out species. What happened in the 20th century to get people really interested in conservation?
Well, I think one thing that happened is that people actually realized that extinction is possible. It's really interesting. You opened with speaking about passenger pigeons, and actually when passenger pigeons went extinct, there was sort of a collective sense of disbelief in North America that this could have actually happened. There was even some speculation that, you know, they must have flown to South America. So one of the things that changed was just our scientific understanding that actually species are not sort of infinite resources, but that they're actually capable of going extinct.
You had an experience at the Bronx Zoo that drove you to want to learn as much as you could about extinction prevention efforts and conservation. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I was a graduate student in New York City in journalism, and I was taking a fascinating course called Covering Ideas. And for I wanted to cover the idea of arcs and the fact that with some species, in order to save them, scientists and conservation biologists are having to literally bring them in from the wild and put them in arcs in order to keep them safe. And one of the species that I found an example of was, you know, right near me in New York at the Bronx Zoo, and it was a species called the Kihansi spray toad. It had gone extinct in the wild, and there was two captive populations left, one at the Bronx Zoo and one at the Toledo Zoo. And those were the only frogs left in the world. They had come from a single waterfall in Tanzania. They were extraordinarily rare.
It's very strange to think about how to consider them. They're extinct in the wild. They exist in captivity. Does that make them functionally extinct, or does the fact that a few remain mean there is hope for bringing them back?
Well, there is a lot of hope that scientists can put species that are extinct in the wild back in the landscape. The Kihansi spray toad really shows how difficult that is. And so you could say that the Kihansi spray toad has been saved, but it has undoubtedly been changed by the fact that it's had to come into a captive breeding program. At one point, the entire world population of Kihansi spray toads shrunk to 72 individuals. So that's kind of the genetic snapshot of that species. And when it was first discovered, there was tens of thousands.
Hmm. One surprising thing that you learned is how much biologists don't know about how many species there actually are on the planet at this moment. Notwithstanding how many are going extinct right now, what suggests that the estimates might be too high simply of how many species exist on Earth?
So I think there's been a lot of numbers discussed, and I'm not an expert on it, but the sources that I found that I consider to be authoritative put the estimate of species on Earth somewhere between 3 and 8 million, which is quite different from some of the estimates of sort of tens of millions of species. And that sort of affects how we think about extinction and extinction rates during this period of enormous biodiversity depletion, because some of how scientists have projected extinction rates has to do with how many species we assume there are. But I think that this 3 to 8 million number makes a lot of sense. Although I will say I'm not actually a trained scientist, I'm a journalist. So,
well, if the relative number of species that exists on Earth is smaller, does that mean that any one extinction actually carries greater weight?
Oh, sure. I think you could definitely say that. You know, in the same way that one species isn't an infinite resource, we could also say that, you know, biodiversity isn't just an infinite resource, and that these things are actually finite and therefore even more priceless than we thought.
Answer a question for me that after all your research probably sounds really obvious to you, and that is, why is biodiversity important?
Well, I think a lot of the arguments that we hear in the public from scientists and conservation biologists and even policymakers is very focused on the utilitarian argument. So biodiversity is critical to ecosystem health and therefore, you know, our own species survival. Or, you know, you could say the value of a species is it has some kind of medical application, or even the argument that these are aesthetically beautiful species. You know, those are sort of utilitarian arguments. There's a lot of other really interesting arguments that, to me, after writing this book, make a lot of sense. One is this idea of intrinsic value. I interviewed a really well-respected environmental ethicist, really the father of the field, Holmes Rolston the third, and his work has really focused on this idea of intrinsic value, that a species' value isn't dependent on us, on our ability to judge, but it's actually intrinsic to the existence of that species. And another argument that I really liked a lot was one by another ethicist named Edward McCord, who says, you know, species have this value that comes from being able to intellectually inspire humans, and that, in fact, our sort of intellectual capacities have been informed by that throughout our own history.
And it may well be that in terms of, you know, practical value, that we simply don't comprehend what these things do within the environment at this moment in our own intellectual development.
That's absolutely true. One of the species that I write about in the book is a North Atlantic right whale. Mm-hmm. And sometime in the middle of writing about this species, there was some papers that came out talking about the role that whales play in terms of the ocean ecosystem and recycling nutrients and phytoplankton, and actually that whales play this important role in terms of global warming. You know, and that's really fascinating, because at the same time that, you know, global warming may be impacting these whales, we may also need these whales in order to sort of mitigate some of the effects of global warming.
Describe right whales. What are they exactly? How big are they?
Oh, right whales are enormous. You know, imagine a school bus. I think the calves when they're born are about 1,100 pounds. So these are enormous creatures. But funny enough, they're actually kind of difficult to find in the ocean unless you know where to look. And for some of these whales, you know, they appear and then disappear. And scientists have had a difficult time tracking them. And of course, if you don't know where animals are, it's very hard to understand what they need in order to survive and how best to protect them.
Can you tell us a little bit about this mysterious specimen known as 1334?
Sure. 1334 is a whale, a female whale. That number is assigned to her by the New England Aquarium, which maintains a database of all the known whales. There's about 500 or so alive today. And 1334 is fascinating and kind of made her the central character of the chapter on these whales. You know, every 3 years she shows up on the coast of southern Georgia and Florida with a calf. That's where they go. The water's warmer, and whales go there to give birth. And then she disappears, and she only shows up again 3 years later. And she's been doing that for about three decades, irrespective of how fertility seems to be dropping or rising within the rest of the population. So one of the questions, you know, that researchers have been trying to ask is, where are whales, her and a few dozen others, where are they going? And why, in her case, is her reproductive power so great?
Whales are much harder than a lot of other animals to keep alive in captivity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with the North Atlantic right whale, the whole idea of trying to start a captive breeding, you know, program or something like that is just completely, you know, it doesn't make any sense. So it's a particularly challenging case. And also, you know, these are whales that seem to have a pretty slow rate of evolution. So there's concern that they may not be able to adapt fast enough to changes that are happening to their food source and habitat.
Maura, what have you learned about the things that play into decisions about which animal species receive our assistance in staying alive if their numbers are dwindling and which ones don't?
Well, it's interesting. In the case of the Kihansi spray toad, one of the things that motivated their conservation was certainly not just the concern of biologists who had discovered the toad and believed that this was an enormously significant species because it existed nowhere else except for this one waterfall, but it also was the threat of a public relations nightmare. The hydroelectric dam that was being funded by the World Bank and was diverting the water, you know, this would have been sort of a nightmare for the World Bank if they had caused the extinction of a species. And interestingly, as an aside, you know, some conservation groups, I was told, were sort of almost disappointed that the species hadn't gone extinct because they finally would have had sort of a legal case against the World Bank, which I think for the most part is sort of considered not to have a very great environmental record.
Is it possible to draw a line anymore between wilderness and territory that's been affected by human activity?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think it kind of goes to the heart of what conservation biologists and environmental ethicists are having to think about these days. Global warming is sort of a major game changer in terms of, you know, how we think about wilderness and wild things and humans and where those things all overlap. You know, you could say there's very few places left on Earth that either haven't been affected or won't be affected by changes in the climate that scientists are seeing and predicting. And so this boundary between wilderness and sort of humans is getting really blurred. And I think for conservation, that's a big deal. You know, you could say humans have manipulated species, you know, since for thousands and thousands of years. You only have to go to the grocery store to see how we manipulate species. But with conservation, you know, wilderness is sort of at the heart of that ethic, and it's quite challenging.
My guest is journalist M.R. O'Connor. Her new book is Resurrection Science: Conservation, De-Extinction, and the Precarious Future of Wild Things. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
The first discovery was made in the spring of 1990. From a mine in South America came a piece of amber containing the fossilized remains of a prehistoric mosquito, one of many that had fed upon the blood of dinosaurs. From the DNA in that blood, science was able to recreate those giants. And for the first time, man and dinosaur shared the earth. It happened at a place called Jurassic Park.
This is Think on KERA. That was a teaser to the 1993 Jurassic Park film, which of course spawned other films, including this summer's Jurassic World. My guest this hour is journalist M.R. O'Connor. We're talking about her book, Resurrection Science, Conservation, De-Extinction, and the Precarious Future of Wild Things. And to be clear, Maura, the stuff in Jurassic Park is the stuff of fiction.
It is, and I think will remain so for the foreseeable future.
However, it is many people are believing that it is possible to use other techniques to quite literally rebuild or recreate species that have been dead for some time.
Yeah, the technology is advancing. To date, you know, there's no self-sustaining population of de-extincted animals out there. And I'd say, you know, it's 10 to 20 years even before, you know, we could be looking at a recreated passenger pigeon.
So let's talk a little bit more about the passenger pigeon. If we were to bring them back, there is a question as to whether, let's assume that everything went brilliantly and they were healthy, they wouldn't necessarily be the same as the passenger pigeons from whom their DNA was derived.
That's right. I think that's a really important thing to point out when we're talking about de-extinction efforts is, you know, the way that you would sort of resurrect a passenger pigeon is actually by editing the DNA of a living relative, which in this case would be a band-tailed pigeon. And so what you're really talking about is a genetically modified organism that may indeed look like a passenger pigeon, but we don't really know whether it would have the same behaviors of a passenger pigeon, nor would it, you know, you wouldn't necessarily understand or could predict how it was going to behave or play a role in the modern ecology and landscape.
And this new species or revived species would literally have to figure out how to do things for the first time. Assuming that we could artificially revive a flock of passenger pigeons, we open the doors to the lab one day, we set them free, could they find what they need to survive in a 21st century landscape?
It seems that, you know, passenger pigeons would have to be taught to a certain extent how to be a passenger pigeon, how to forage for food, how to travel in flocks. And the young molecular biologist who's really committed his life to seeing passenger pigeons brought back into the world, Ben Novak, is a really inspiring and passionate young guy, and his idea is that you could actually be able to train passenger pigeon flocks in this way by sort of cosmetically painting related pigeons who could teach passenger pigeons certain behaviors. The question is, you know, how many passenger pigeons do you need to create a self-sustaining population? Is it the hundreds of millions that colonists to America saw, or is it a question of density? Would you just need a flock that had a certain level of density in order for them to be self-sustaining in the wild once again?
Some people, of course, have raised questions about whether the passenger pigeons were certainly affected by human activity, but were also a victim of the fact that there were so many of them in the 19th century.
I think there's, as far as I know, there's no real debate over the, you know, that humans caused the extinction of passenger pigeons. When you read the descriptions of the hunts that were going on, I mean, passenger pigeons would flock in tens of millions, and people were just going and shooting them. Here in New York, where I am at the moment, you know, people were eating passenger pigeon and buying them for, you know, 10 birds for one penny. That's how ubiquitous they were.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak on the phone now to Brad in Plano. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out that very often we don't find out till later on what value certain animals could be to humans. For example, there's a lizard called a Gila monster, and the saliva of the Gila monster has been shown to produce a medicine which helps diabetics and replaces insulin. And because of that, it is very beneficial to diabetics.
Thanks for your call. Maura, anything you want to respond to?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And I think that that is true. We don't understand the value of species sometimes till much later. But one thing I would point out is that sometimes the trouble with making a utilitarian argument for why we should be saving species can almost backfire, because if there's no clear use or value for them, or, you know, if we don't know it today, then, how do we articulate an argument for preserving that species? And so from a kind of philosophical viewpoint, the utilitarian argument, although, you know, undoubtedly true in all sorts of respects, is kind of hard to use in every case.
The way that nature works is that any species that exists in a particular habitat on a particular landscape is going to affect the species around it, maybe beneficially in some cases, maybe adversely in other cases. To bring back things that have already gone extinct might have an adverse effect on those species that have been thriving all along.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely true, we can't really predict. It may be that a resurrected passenger pigeon released into northeastern forests would act more as an invasive species. It's also, the naturalist Aldo Leopold described passenger pigeons as this sort of biological storm, that they almost acted like wildfires because there were so many. They recycled nutrients, they toppled trees, and modern Americans are hugely intolerant of wildfires. The question is, why would we welcome back an animal that had that kind of role in the modern landscape? On the other hand, there's been some science showing that maybe the sort of outbreak levels of Lyme disease that we see today are related to passenger pigeon extinction. So without competing with deer and mice, carriers of the ticks that spread Lyme disease, that's maybe one reason why we're seeing so many cases of it today. So it's hard to say, really weigh the negatives and positives.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Tony's on the line in North Dallas. Hi, Tony.
Hi, great conversation. Glad to be able to take part in it. Just wanted to comment on the situation that most people are aware of now in Taiji, Japan. The killing of dolphins has greatly slowed down. And the reason for that is because so many people have found out about it. And that scenario can be applied to any species, not just dolphins, because they are so lovable and so responsive. Really just wanted to make the point that for the long run, for next generations, I'm hoping that we can point out other animals in the food chain that will affect, for the long run, the other species and try to prevent their extinction. But specifically, very happy that the hunting has slowed down in Taiji, and very happy about, your show. Y'all always bring up some interesting points. So I'm hoping that we get some updates on Taiji.
Thanks for your call. Anything you want to respond to there?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more that sort of our consciousness and our awareness is sort of everything when we're talking about conservation. And of course, the sort of public awareness is at a premium right now. There's so many things vying for our attention. But certainly one thing that I think is hugely important is our ability to educate ourselves about these issues. And with something like de-extinction, which maybe seems so science fiction-y to almost be silly, what would be wonderful is if we can have a public debate about it now, in order so that when the technology is really advanced and this is actually, you know, happening, public opinion, you know, can speak for or against it.
You write here about the work of some scientists trying to preserve at least the genetic material of threatened species, a DNA bank.
That's right. I was able to visit several times one of a highly respected DNA bank here in New York City in the basement of the American Museum of Natural History. And that particular bank has over 87,000 specimens, you know, cryogenically frozen for future generations. And the main purpose of these banks, and there are hundreds of them, is really research. It's so that, you know, conservation geneticists and biologists and molecular biologists can look into this DNA and better understand evolutionary relationships and species. But there's also a kind of implicit mission to these banks, which is that if we can't guarantee that this genetic material will be preserved into the future in living things, then we have an ethical responsibility to preserve that material for future generations, you know, a time when we can't really know what technology they will have, but hopefully, you know, they'll be able to do something with it.
Maura, do the people who work at these banks even acknowledge the potential for their contents to be used, you know, in a post-apocalyptic situation?
Not necessarily, but I think some of the banks have different missions than others. So the emphasis at the collection at the American Museum of Natural History is really research, whereas at a collection like the Frozen Zoo at in San Diego, at part of the San Diego Zoo, the mission has a lot more to do with preserving tissues, sperm, eggs from endangered species, with the explicit intention of, you know, being able to help endangered species with reproduction, and even potentially, you know, creating stem cells that could be used in all sorts of different ways to bring back species.
Why is cloning so hard to get right? And why is it so hard to create a cloned animal that can reproduce naturally with others of its kind?
Well, the only example, you know, of a de-extinction to date that I'm aware of is something called a Pyrenean ibex, a wild goat. And in 2003, scientists were able to clone this animal from preserved tissue that they had frozen. And, you know, there were hundreds of attempts, and only one animal was born, and it actually died from within several minutes. So that's just an example of how hard it can be. And I think part of it is because we don't necessarily know or can control all sorts of other factors that influence the success of that process. So, for instance, it's not just about sort of DNA. It's also about epigenetics. It's also about the surrogate.
To what extent did working on all of this make you think more consciously about, you know, that maybe the best de-extinction effort is to prevent extinction in the first place, and what the ways to do that might be?
Yeah, I started out writing the book being a skeptic about de-extinction, and I think that I'm still a skeptic, although I have great respect for the individuals who are working on it and have this kind of incredible vision. I'm still a skeptic, and I think because every story that I wrote for this book, there's sort of eight species, you know, in the end, everything came back to the loss of habitat, the inability for these species to be given the space that they need. And a great example of that is the Florida panther. You know, in the 1970s, when Florida Panthers were sort of rediscovered, this remnant population in Florida, there was only 30. And today there's 180. So they're kind of a conservation success story. And yet there's nowhere for these panthers to really go. And people actually really resent the fact that there are more panthers and, you know, they're showing up in people's backyards and they're killing cattle. And, you know, those are real concerns. But so even with these conservation success stories, what you see is they all come down to whether or not animals have enough space to survive. And it kind of almost seemed to me that, you know, we put a little too much faith in technology to solve some of the problems that are facing us today when it comes to the sixth extinction. But the answers are pretty simple, you know, but obviously very complicated in action.
Where are the people who do this sort of work getting funding for it? Is this coming from governments? Is it coming from private funders?
That's a good question. You know, the efforts that I'm aware of are done within academic research institutions. And so that seems to be the main thing. And there may be other funding going on, but I'm actually not aware of it.
Most of us don't think of ourselves as being related to the problem of extinction, right? It seems like maybe it's the collective we have caused some damage.
Right.
Do we need to think in a more direct way about, you know, where our houses are located, where we decided to build, you know, a business or a road, and how that affects the natural world?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the sixth extinction does feel overwhelming. It's abstract. It's not something that seems related to most of our everyday lives. I live in New York. You know, that is certainly true for me and most of the people, I think, who are my neighbors. And yet, I think there's many ways that we can be engaged in land use issues that are within our immediate communities. And certainly, you know, that's an important part of trying to mitigate some of the environmental crises that we are facing collectively.
We're speaking this hour with journalist M.R. O'Connor. Her new book is called Resurrection Science: Conservation, De-Extinction, and the Precarious Future of Wild Things. Join us at 800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist M.R. O'Connor, author of Resurrection Science: Conservation, De-Extinction, and the Precarious Future of Wild Things. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Maura, you were talking about the idea that people are working on possibly recreating an extinct type of rhinoceros from cells that are reprogrammed in a lab and then implanted into a living rhinoceros to bear. And you were really left with this question about what a rhino actually is. Is that kind of lab-fabricated version of an extinct rhinoceros the same as the creature that is gone?
Right. Yeah, it's a fascinating case that northern white rhinos, there's actually, when I started writing the book, there was 7 left in the world. And then when I finished writing the book, there was 5. 2 of them died from natural causes in that period. And I was able to go to Kenya and meet 4 of them. And they are incredible creatures. It was an amazing, incredibly memorable experience. But when we're talking about resurrecting something like the northern white rhino, which is almost certainly doomed to extinction, it sort of brings up this question of what is a species, and is a resurrected animal the same as an original species? And it may seem sort of like a irrelevant debate, but it actually does have implications because, it sort of bears the question, what moral standing would we give to a de-extincted animal? What legal protections would we give to a de-extincted animal? Is a passenger pigeon brought back to life in the laboratory eligible for protection under the Endangered Species Act? And I think there's real concern that as the technology advances, this will be a real issue that policymakers are confronted with, and also maybe that there could be a lot of shenanigans when it comes to trying to enforce something like the Endangered Species Act when you can't actually prove that extinction is forever.
There's been a great deal of talk over the past couple of weeks about the discovery of yet another human species. They're calling it Homo naledi, found in South Africa. Of course, we now know that Homo sapiens and Neanderthals coexisted and even interbred. Should we consider ourselves responsible, first of all, for the extinction of Neanderthals?
It's not totally clear to me, but I feel from my conversations that I had with experts that probably we were very involved. Maybe we didn't all outright cause it, but we may have, been a nail in the coffin, so to speak.
Certainly we could learn a great deal from de-extincting Neanderthals through cloning and surrogacy, but the ethical implications of making a human, even a different kind of human, for research purposes are chilling.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, this sort of brings some of the ethical questions at the heart of the de-extinction argument to bear. We would never say that if we resurrected a human from DNA that, that would, that human would be everything that we are. It's about culture, it's about epigenetics, it's about environment, lots of other things. So this idea of bringing back a Neanderthal is sort of strange because, it sort of shows what a fantasy that actually is. And yet, I completely agree with George Church, the geneticist at Harvard Medical School, who has sort of written about this topic that, it's one we can't really just dismiss it out of hand. It's actually quite important that we debate this, considering where the technology is going.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Phil in Plano. Hello, Phil.
Hello. I'm calling to tell you about a suggestion of the Nobel Prize winner E.O. Wilson, who has got a new suggestion about a new compromise that we could make with the other species. He might be a little bit too generous to us and not generous enough to the other species, but what he suggests is that we should give half the world to them and keep the other half just for ourselves. How do you like that?
That's a fascinating idea, and I have enormous respect for E.O. Wilson and his writing. And it's interesting. One thing that's happening is this sort of movement of humans into cities, in this process of urbanization. On the one hand, you can say, this sort of concrete jungle certainly couldn't be good for species. But one thing that it might do is actually relieve the pressure in sort of rural areas. Although, we're predicted to, I think, have 9 billion humans on Earth by 2050, is it? I'm not exactly sure. And that's really, it's just kind of, bewilders the mind how many people that is. So certainly the pressures that are happening today are going to increase. Maybe we do have to just sort of rope off half the Earth and say, okay, this is for you guys and we'll keep the rest.
The question is, could we trust ourselves to evenly divide the good half and the bad half,
Exactly. Well, one of the things I found out writing this book, which is really interesting to me, is that the creation of national parks in this country, at least, was sort of partly informed by taking places that didn't have value or too hard to develop and sort of saying, well, okay, we'll just turn this into, a beautiful place for people to go and visit.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Tom on the line in Red Oak. Hey, Tom.
Hi. You kind of actually touched on what I was getting at, because I was curious if you had done research on the human overpopulation problem and how it affects and drives extinction. The Florida panther, for example, there's never going to be enough room in Florida for that creature to actually thrive and to grow into the numbers, you know, for a healthy community to be into. It's effectively always going to be caged by the human population. And
that's
as
right.
You pointed out, with the human population growth that's expected, you know, by like 2050, we're supposed to be hitting close to 20 billion people on the planet. So,
what do you think about all that, Maura?
No, he's absolutely right. The Florida panther case is, really troubling. I think Florida just passed New York as the third populous state in the country. And so this idea of taking an endangered species that is highly regulated under the Endangered Species Act and trying to move it out of southern Florida, there's no states that are volunteering to take endangered Florida panthers. It's just expensive. People don't necessarily want to live next to wild animals, you know, particularly ranchers and farmers, and, you know, it's not hard to see why. And so I think this is a real question that we, you know, different communities and collectively we are going to have to answer is, you know, how much do we value wild things and how much do we want them to be a part of our future?
Back to the phones again. We have Anna on the line in Denton. Hey, Anna.
Hi. I just had a question, like, kind of pertaining to the panthers as well. When there's so many, and then eventually it gets to a problem, and I know that, like, whenever there is a certain animal species on the list, it's kind of hard to get them off the list if they do become a certain issue, if there is too many, or if they interact with the wildlife around them negatively. I guess it kind of goes with an example that I was thinking of in Telos. It's an island in Greece close to Asia Minor. And what the thing is that they have too many goats there. But, I mean, like, they use them for certain resources. But how would you get rid of those goats if they're overgrazing?
Right. Well, I don't know if those goats are endangered or not. I mean, that would have a huge, you know, that would change how you would deal with them. With the case of the Florida panthers, which I know a little bit about from having written about them in one chapter in the book, is, you know, in order to delist Florida panthers, they would need two more populations of 240 individuals each. So, you know, in order for them to not be legally protected in the way that they are, you need a huge increase in the population. And, you know, I one of the individuals I interviewed for that chapter is a man named Roy McBride, who discovered this remnant population in the 1970s and has been intimately involved with management of the population. And the way he put it, which I thought was great, is, you know, people who don't live next to Florida panthers think they're great and want them to thrive and grow and, you know, have all the space they need. And people who actually need to live next to Florida panthers don't want that. And that's actually true, I think, for even at a broader scale. You know, I came to the Kihansi spray toad story thinking, of course, we should save this toad, you know, this rare toad. When I actually went to Tanzania, you know, the idea that we would save this toad and sort of deny electricity-starved Tanzanians, you know, from getting this really important resource, electricity, just didn't really make any sense anymore. And I think that's really one of the crux of the issues when we're talking about the sixth extinction is, you know, how are humans and animals going to survive if really it's sort of demanding sacrifices of us in order to conserve them?
The reasons that some people are very uncomfortable with the idea of de-extincting animals that are already gone are understandable. In some cases, they may be defensible. But it doesn't make sense to say we just shouldn't mess with nature. We just shouldn't, have input into what lives and what dies because we have been doing that for thousands of years by the fact of our presence.
Right. Yeah, I think it is really hard to say, you know, we can't do that because it would create some kind of artificial world or artificial creature, you know. And obviously, humans have been impacting consciously or unconsciously species for, you know, tens and tens of thousands of years. But I do think sort of one of the arguments against the extinction that we should really be debating is that, you know, we should ask whether it's really solving problems at the root of the sixth extinction. You know, we should ask, is this part of a conservation strategy? And it may be for certain species that, you know, we're bringing something back that plays a crucial ecological role that's missing. But, you know, to the species itself, it doesn't really matter. They're dead. So, you know, I think we have to be very rigorous in questioning the motives behind the extinction and really test them to see, you know, is this actually a conservation strategy or is it something totally different, just something that's really neat?
We live in interesting times because certainly our ancestors were responsible for a number of extinctions, but we are among the first couple of generations that can understand that. You know what I mean? Like they may have done the deed, but they really didn't get what they were doing and the fact that it was permanent. We understand this, so we have a responsibility in a way that maybe they did not.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. I think, you know, it wasn't necessarily clear that animals could go extinct, and now we know that. And so with that, you know, has evolved a whole set of values and arguments of why we should actually evolve an environmental consciousness. And, you know, in some ways, that's a pretty nascent thing. That's something that's only happened, as you said, in the last few generations. And what's tricky about the time that we're living in is that things are changing so fast, faster than we can really internalize or comprehend. And will our sort of environmental ethics and our values and our consciousness and political processes catch up to the rate of change that's happening and really be able to mitigate some of the worst aspects of it?
Where do you draw the line between humans and nature, if you draw one at all?
Well, I think that in some ways I'm a bit of a maybe conservative in the sense of I actually do think that wilderness is not just sort of a construct, but it's actually something that's real and has value. And so I actually, you know, do think protecting that is really important. I don't actually think just because, you know, human action is also natural that that means that we can just change everything and not worry about it because it's all natural. But I also think that, you know, the reality today is we can't draw such a hard black and white line and that we actually have to really grapple with the fact that that's not the case anymore. You know, it's with global warming, it's sort of changed everything.
The new book by journalist M.R. O'Connor is called Resurrection Science: Conservation, De-Extinction, and the Precarious Future of Wild Things. Maura, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.